Ingle, Oladamare, Jinyami, Olorun, God, Jehovah, Allah, Amun-Ra, the many names for the original ancestor, the ancestor who sees all and knows all, the creator of the heavens and the earth. We do not pour libation to you, but this morning we come pouring libation in memory and honor of our ancestors and asking them to intercede with you on our behalf. We know that our ancestors, being in the spirit world, are closer to you, and there's a greater opportunity that our requests will be granted. We ask this morning that you grant the listeners the willingness to open their hearts and their minds to the information that's going to be shared, such that they will hear the truth and then be able to act on the truth. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To our ancestors from Mother Africa, the ancestors who were the beginning of the human family that we now have, no matter what your ethnic or cultural background is, the beginning of human life as we know it was on the African continent. Every person on the face of the earth has as their original ancestor an African. We ask those Africans who were the first to conceive of a family, the first to plant a seed, the first to till the land, the first to domesticate animals, the first to navigate the mighty Nile River to Egypt, the first to build a skyscraper, the first to do surgeries, the first to explore the wonders of the galaxy, and as importantly, the first to conceive of the belief in one God. We ask those ancestors to come and be with us today, to bring their wisdom, their hard work, their ingenuity to all that we do. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To our ancestors who were murdered, displaced, diminished during our great Holocaust, our great Miafa, we do not forget you. We remember your unwilling sacrifice as your bodies are lined the Sahara and the Atlantic Ocean. We remember you and we honor you and we ask that you come and be with us today. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. We ask our ancestors who gave us the great document, the Ma'at, to come be with us, bring your additional sense of honor and integrity as embodied by Ma'at to our discussions and our listings this morning. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation. To those ancestors from the Caribbean islands, from Brazil, from the southern parts of these United States, who through your unpaid labor laid the groundwork for the civilizations that are enjoyed by billions of people around the world. To those ancestors, we say we do not forget you. We remember your sacrifice, your hard work. And we ask that you come and be with us today to inspire us to also do the work required to correct a world that has gone mad. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation.
Libation.
And to those ancestors who are yet to be born, those ancestors for whom we do good work, those ancestors to whom we pledge to honorably do righteous work all the time for ourselves, for our families, for our communities, so we can be correct to be able to benefit from the largesse that the Creator has provided for all of us. Ancestors, we pledge ourselves to continue to do work such that when you return, this place will be a better earth. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We say libation.
Libation.
And finally, we'd like to ask you in our audience to think of one of your ancestors, someone who you would like to be with us this morning. On the count of three, ask that ancestor to come and be with us. One, two, three. Ancestors, come and get your drink. We said libation, libation, libation.
Libation.
It is good.
That people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Apologize for being black, for all I am plus all I lack. Please, sir, please, ma'am, give me some slack, cause I apologize. I apologize for being poor, for being sick and tired and so. Since I ain't slick, don't know the scope, I do apologize. I apologize because I bear resemblance most black people share. Thick lips, flat nose, and nappy hair. Yes, I apologize. I apologize for how I look, for all the lows and blows I took. On those, Lord knows I'd close the book as I apologize. I apologize for all I gave, for letting you make me your slave. And go into my early grave. Yes, I apologize. I apologize for being caught, for being sold, for being bought, while being told I count for naught. Yeah, I apologize. I apologize for all I've done, for all my toil out in the sun. Don't want to spoil your righteous fun, so I apologize. I apologize and curse my kind for being fooled, for being blind, for being ruled and in your bind. Yes, I apologize. I apologize and curse my fate for being slow, for being late, because I know it's me you hate. Why not apologize? I apologize and tip my hat, because you so rich and free and fat. Son of a bitch, that's where it's at. And I apologize.
Welcome to Kentucky. We deal with friendship. We love to get along. Kentucky loves each other. I love you, Kentucky. Ow.
Shame to be dappy head and all, ain't no change in me. So up it was, downright wrong, I tell you. Nobody never gave us nothing. The tough time, it made us something different. Stretch the road, new something to see. Every state on the map, a different something to eat. Daps and handshakes, it meant nothing for real. Everybody making the killing, man, showing no feelings. Walking off collective pay is the way of the world. Can't change it, so I guess I'm gonna pray for the world. Sometimes I ask myself, was I made for the world? I scream this to you, and I say to the world, nappy then, nappy now, nappy for a bit. Knee deep, head over heels in this country.
All my life been poor, but it really don't matter no more. And they wonder why we act this way. Nappy boys gonna be okay.
I've been here all my life.
Everybody gets to know everybody.
It's down home, good old-fashioned people.
It's country. I like it.
There's nothing better than that, man.
I just love Kentucky.
All my life been poor, but it really don't matter no more. And they wonder why we act this way. Nappy boys gonna be okay.
Even though I picture better days, I'm thankful for the chance I got to say amen. The Lord done blessed me with his grace. I wish his days would never end. We represent the slum. Where we from? We built it on. Falling short off on these presidents in hard times. That going come soon. Take a fall without the chance to make it at all. Who would have thought skinny be the one that's making this call? Lord, help me out. Tell me where I went wrong. I'm trying to find the righteous path, although it's never been long. I gotta do it for my son's sake, telling me daddy be strong. We gonna make it through these hard times, even though they go when they come. You're absolutely right, but something happened to me on last Tuesday night, as plain as day, man. They with this world trade, no, brave ain't the word I'm looking for. Yeah, better make it hope when nothing seems to matter. That's when, see, everything can go any which way. They got me folk, see, the Henny with the J, front post chilling broke. Country folk, man, I'm nappy in my way. Yeah.
I've been poor, but it really don't matter no more. And they wonder why we act this way. Nappy boys gonna be okay.
We're gonna be okay.
This morning, all my colorful stressing, calm, let's join hands. Got to go with the pressures of being poor, man. Papa taught me in order to survive for no man. Nappy blossom from the root, henceforth we gon' stand. Prophet grew from a juvenile to a grown man. You gotta take responsibility for your own, man. Zoning, too blind to moaning by sunrise. Sometimes I love to hear my woman moaning. It's gone again. Damn, I hope he play this song again. The soul cleansing, the melody just rare my engine. Tried a lot of things, but usually just a bend in my ligament. Searching for Benjamins. All my folks locked in the tenements, and it don't make any sense.
Why?
Children are innocent, broadcasting from the slum. That's why I'm writing these sentences. Alone, my income, why? Go ahead, finish.
All my life, I've been poor, but it really don't matter no more. And they wonder why we act this way.
are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Greetings, my sisters and brothers, and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. And my name is William Rogers, and I am your host for the evening. I hope wherever you are, you have had a wonderful and pleasant day. Here in Wisconsin, where we are broadcasting from, we are beginning to get the remnants of fall, along with which doesn't last long because winter moves in very quickly. So anyway, we have been enjoying nice weather prior to this, and I'm so happy to be with you here this evening. We have a wonderful conversation that we are going to talk about with you and some of our audience, and hopefully that we can look at some solutions that we want to do. A lot of times when we're choosing programs and looking at ideas, it goes about as the weeks are moving on, we look at things and we see how things are progressing. Right now, you know, we're dealing with a whole lot of different factors that impact particularly the African-American community. As we have so often said on here over the last of the summer, you know, COVID-19, we know about that. We're dealing with this astronomical amount of police shootings, the crazy attitude from many of our white brothers and sisters that has always been there, but it has heightened somewhat based on this administration that we now have in office, and just so many other things. And then the economic disparity that all of this has created. So many of our people are out of work, are not able to provide the necessities for themselves and their families. And then we are hit with going back to school. Our young people are going, and they're going to have to go in an unusual way. And so I thought about that today. I've been thinking about that over the last couple of weeks and looking at how that impacts our community, how it impacts families. But how is this going to impact the education about children? In many cases, they were being challenged by this corrupt system that attempts to educate them, and we obviously want to know what is it that's being done, and now what will this virtual learning and being able to have to go to school via the computer, and we know the regimentation that is required to do that and to sit at a computer all day or half of a day, and having our children learn. You're talking about 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds sitting at a computer attempting to try and to learn in a way that's positive for them. So I've been thinking about all that and looking at it. But I've been thinking about it in a deeper perspective and looking at it, going back as a historian. I always have to place things in history and look at that and kind of see what our ancestors have said about some of this kinds of stuff, and just look at the whole system of education in general, like that was done by, you know, our dear brother, Dr. Carter G. Woodson, in his book, The Miseducation of the Negro. And we've talked about that miseducation process that's been going on for a very long time, and it still is going on. And so what are we seeing? When we look at COVID-19, we look at the behavior of police departments, which I think has a lot of deeper meaning than we're getting. This is not haphazard kind of behavior. This may very well have been planned behavior, but because we don't have the evidence, I guess you kind of can only do it as a speculative thought. And like I said, I'm a historian. I do believe in evidence, but I also believe in speculation sometimes that helps us to get to the evidence that we need to have. And so that's kind of where our program is today. I want to speculate about a few things. I have a strong basis on where that speculation comes from. It comes from our ancestors. And I was reading something over the week, and I looked at it, and I said, here we go. This is making sense. And so I want to share that with you, our audience, and have you give me your feedback to tell me if you see that in a lot of ways that we're looking at doing things. So that's the gist of our conversation tonight, is about education, educating our children. And what is it that this environment that we are operating in, how successful are we going to be in doing that? And if it's not going to help them, if it is going to hurt in some way, then what do we do as a community? That's the major question. What is it that we do as a community? And I can cut right through the chase on that one, and I've been arguing this for many, many years. And I definitely have talked about it many, many times on this program. And that is the idea of community schools, what we call Saturday schools, where the community comes together and educate our children. We cannot wait for anybody else to do that. And we have had a real bad habit of doing and letting other people do that for us. And so we need to do that. I had a young sister on not too long ago from Dallas, Texas, who had organized a Saturday school program called Boom. And she just sent me some material today talking about the graduation from the summer and how successful that was. And that's a community effort. That was not funded by any board of education. It was not funded by any foundations. Yeah, this was done through her own inner structure, inner relationships that she had, and raising funds to kind of do that. So, that's kind of what I'm posing. And a lot of times, that's the golden objective, is to continue to encourage our community in some way to start educating our children ourselves. There's no better place to do that in history. We've done that. The Black Church, for instance, was the major institution for being able to create schools, and where there was a poor education structure or lack of education, the Black Churches stepped forward and pitched in and created that. And as we've said so often, you know, a lot of these universities that we see, these HBCUs, started in the basement of churches. And so the church is in a real strong position to support an initiative such as some kind of a community school, Saturday school approach. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit about the historical connection of it. But before we do, as always, you know, I like to do that ancestral profile, and I decided to do the ancestral profile today on basically around the subject that we are talking about, where there have been instances and recognitions that the educational system that our children are operating on is ineffective, and we just cannot sit by and let them continue to destroy our children and destroy the educational process of community. So I want to talk about a brother that passed and not long ago. He's a recent ancestor that transitioned in April 18th of this year, but his name is Rhody McCoy. Rhody McCoy. Brother Dr. McCoy headed what was known at one time as the Brooklyn School District, where teacher transfers back in 1968 sparked a bitter and racially charged dispute over union seniority and community control. Rhody McCoy was a veteran Black educator who preemptory transfer of white teachers from his Brooklyn school district in 1968 touched off a citywide strike that closed schools for a week and exposed a rift among African liberals over the issue of race, education, and trade unionism. He died on April the 18th at his home in Palm Desert, California. He was 97 years old. What became known of that history? And actually, as quiet as it kept, you know, when we think about civil rights and we think about a lot of the movements in the civil rights struggle, we always think about the South. We think about that, and even maybe the March on Washington. And if you were to ask people what was the largest demonstration in the history of the civil rights movement from the Brown decision all the way up until 1976, what most people would say, something that happened in the South or either the March on Washington. Well, it wasn't. It was in New York City. It was the largest civil rights demonstration of people involved anywhere in the United States during that whole history of that 25-year thing that we call the civil rights movement. And we'll talk about that in just a minute, too. But first of all, Brother McCoy, as I said, became known in the 68 school wars in New York City, was the culmination of efforts by reformers to grant local communities greater control over the curriculum and hiring in response to parents' complaints that their children were failing academically. By the late 1960s, most students in the city's public schools were black or Hispanics. A vast majority of teachers and supervisors were white. An experiment in community control in three of the districts, including one called the Ocean Hill-Brownsville in Brooklyn, where Dr. McCoy was the local administrator, became a crucible for racial conflict in a city undergoing demographic upheaval. Dr. McCoy's pipe-puffing persona belied his militant commitment both to the black nationalism and to the decentralization of school governance, which political and academic progressives were preaching as one way to improve education and restore confidence in the school system. The reformers viewed decentralization as an experiment that would unshackle the underperforming Ocean Hill-Brownsville district from the Board of Education's hide-bound central bureaucracy system that they had in place. But Dr. McCoy preferred to see it as a veritable community control, which would empower a locally elected board of parents and other district residents to choose their children's teachers and their supervisors. The Brooklyn Communities Board's decision in 1968 to transfer 19 teachers and supervisors it deemed second rate, ordinarily, which is a routine procedure, enraged the teachers union, which was called the United Federation of Teachers, that all 19 of those teachers that were chosen to be replaced were white. And it gave the conflict and the appearance that this was a racial issue. The union insisted that the personnel shifts fundamentally threatened the job security it had won from the Board of Education less than a decade earlier in its first collective bargaining agreement. An administrative stalemate occurred. A hearing officer ruled that the teachers should be reinstated, but the local board ignored that order. It touched off a series of strikes that shut the schools down for a million students during 36 of the first 38 days of the fall 1968 term. It led to violent confrontations at local schools and enduring estrangement between black residents who made up most of the neighborhood and Jews who accounted for many of the members of the teachers union. Months of chaos ensued as city officials tried to reconcile the educational theory behind school decentralization with the city's ethnic and racial political realities. If Dr. McCoy had largely faded since then as a forgotten footnote, Albert Shanker, who was the teachers union's president and a lifelong liberal, would be immortalized as a cleric rabble-rouser, notably by many scholars, and they called him, Woody Allen, the filmmaker, created a movie called The Sleeper, in which the protagonist awakens after two centuries in suspended animation to learn that the United States had been destroyed because a man named Albert Shanker got hold of a nuclear warhead. Adding fuel to an already combustible cauldron was supporting cast that included Herman Ferguson, who was nominated as a principal by the district's governing board while under indictment for conspiring to murder moderate civil rights leader Leslie Campbell, who was a black teacher who, during a radio interview, read a poem by a student that included the lines, "You pale-faced Jew boy, I wish you were dead." And John O'Neill, the teachers union vice president, who became alarmed by the rising racial tensions and publicly broke with Mr. Shanker. In her book, The Great School Wars, A History of the New York City Public School System, Diane Ravitch, could you please, Brother Timothy, could you please turn your, mute your mic?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Dr. Rabbit said in an email, he gave legitimacy to their cause. He was not caught in the middle. He enjoyed being the public face of the community control movement, and he must have enjoyed the discomfort that he caused the establishment. But despite the good intentions of Mayor Lindsay, who was the mayor at the time, who supported decentralization to improve failing schools, McGregory Bundy, who was the president of the Ford Foundation, which had initiated the experiment, some supporters said it was doomed from the start. All of the original three demonstration districts were established in minority neighborhoods, inevitably casting the conflict through a racial prism. Control was never clearly defined, nor was the local district given the support it needed to redeem what it considered its mandates, whether because of bungling by the Board of Education's bureaucracy or deliberate sabotage. And then the Civil Liberties Union was brought into this argument, and once the Board of Education understood that what Ocean Hill-Brownsville really wanted was an experiment in genuine community control, it backed off even before it had begun. Rhody McCoy had lamented that such an experiment was even attempted. He said that it was absurd to try to deceive people by giving them programs, uttering promises, and painting them pictures of future success, while at the same time denying them the tools, the techniques, and the power to accomplish all these. He wrote in a letter to the New York City, into the New York Times in 1969. Another player in this picture was a gentleman named Charles Isaacs, who taught at the junior high school 271 in the district and later wrote an article called Inside Ocean Hill-Brownsville, A Teacher's Education. He said in an interview that Rhody came with a vision of bringing black nationalism into the classroom, and he struck with it as long as it was possible. The three demonstration districts were scrapped by the state legislature and replaced in 1969 with a citywide hybrid version of decentralization, which left most of the control back with the central board system. Dr. McCoy in 1967 came in with a vision of bringing back nationalism into the classroom. Rhody Arnold McCoy was born, as I said, on January 16, 1923 in Washington, D.C. He originally wanted to be a doctor, he said, but he was inspired by the teachers in Washington's segregated school system to pursue a career in education. After graduating from Dunbar High School and serving in the Army in the Pacific during World War II, he earned a Bachelor of Science degree from Howard University in 1947, followed by a master's degree from New York University and a doctorate in education from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Dr. McCoy was survived by his wife for 32 years, Carol Richmond McCoy. He had seven children from his first marriage, and he had three children from his last marriage. He had 24 great-grandchildren and a great-great-granddaughter. He joined the New York City school system in 1949 and was an assistant principal at his school for emotionally disturbed boys in Manhattan when he was recruited by the Ocean Hill-Brownsville District shortly after it was established in 1967. Dr. McCoy lived in Roosevelt, New York, and was an acolyte of Malcolm X when he was hired by the Brooklyn District, which had about 9,000 students and about 550 teachers. After the protests subsided in November 1968, he told the New York Magazine that of the 250 teachers he hired, many to replace the strikers, more than 70% were white, and none more than 50% were Jewish. "We have changed a few things in his relatively brief tenure," he told the magazine. "We're trying to get teachers to teach, to get involved with the kids in a one-on-one relationship, not simply stand up in front of a class and dispense facts." But it was hamstrung, and he left in 1970 because, as he wrote in the Times, the central issue in the Ocean Hill-Brownsville upheaval was power and redistribution. Developments reveal, he wrote, that no real distribution of power can take place peaceably in our society. It is clear that these issues are political. This alarms only those clinging to the truth and to the myth that politics and education are separate. He acknowledged that the various factions might have found a way to compromise. One, he said, years later, would be to get rid of me. After the experimental district were abolished in the 1970s, Dr. McCoy, whose close-cropped hairstyle had been then evolved into a short afro, became an assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts, where he directed the Committee for the Collegiate Education of Black Students. He was later director of teacher education at the University of San Francisco, an academic officer at Metropolitan State College in Denver, and the dean of the School of Continuing Education at Federal City College in Washington, which is now part of the University of Washington District. In 1981, when McCoy was enlisted by the District of Columbia system to expand community involvement, the district acting principal said, "We were glad to have him, but he is not the person that he was in Ocean Hill, Brownsville," Rory McCoy. And this, my brothers and sisters, is a very clear picture and a clear image of the politics and the power struggle when it comes to educating our children. This was one of the most outstanding issues, struggles, visible struggles, for real radical change in the American system. The emergence of choice and charter schools has been sort of radical as well, but nothing like what was attempted in Ocean Hill, Brownsville. And as we said, it was a very large demonstration. And it actually happened prior to that, back in 1964. That's the one that we were talking about. That was the largest civil rights demonstration that we've ever had. And that took place back during a time when the same issues were at hand. The children weren't being educated, and parents were upset. They were using textbooks that were antiquated, that were talking about Africans being enslaved and talking about the Confederate soldiers and the war and Hale and Robert E. Lee and all of that kind of stuff. And these teachers wanted to get together and demand that a better process and a better curriculum should be used. And so they called a strike. And and again, hundreds of thousands of parents held their kids back from school for one single day. It was a one-day boycott. And it was the largest boycott within the civil rights movement. And it was done in a way that everyone had to pay attention to it and began to create a scene. One of the things in New York that was unique is that those unions were controlled by Jews. And a lot of their fight was in the Teamsters. So if the Teamsters union, if the teachers went on strike, the Teamsters would right cross the picket line. And so everything else went on strike and could go on strike. And it could create major, major problems. And that's why sometimes it's so challenging to fight the educational system in that way. But very clearly, we know that the teaching and the education system is at the helm of the destruction of our children. They're still teaching Civil War history. They still don't want you to talk about Malcolm X. They still don't want you to talk about Marcus Garvey in any of these programs. And very clearly, the new movement now, the Black Lives Matter and so forth and so on, many schools are banning students from wearing those ornaments that might stress Black Lives Matter, even in terms of the face masks. I was just reading an article that some students from a Georgia school came with, and they had face masks with Black Lives Matter on it, and the teachers, they were sent home by the school because they did not want them reading and looking at that kind of thing. So this is a major battle that has been going on for a long time, and it's still going on. And there is a historical cause behind this, which is what I want to bring up, and then I want to open up, and let's all talk about this together. One of our great, great intellectual giants, ancestors, W.E.B. Du Bois, wrote about this behavior in his career when he was attempting to make some monumental changes around education when he was at Clark Atlanta, and when he was attempting to use the Crisis magazine as his weapon. Dr. Du Bois's theory was that this was an attempt to merge capitalism and caste, C-A-S-T-E. This was a caste system that was being implemented here in America. And it began, according to the Du Bois theory, it begins obviously on the plantation. And how it begins on the plantation, now caste, as you know, is a system of class, there's structures, of economic structures within people groups. You have caste within Europeans, there's the lower class European, you've got the one above that, the working class, the middle class, the upper class, and then you've got the super rich class. And then among the Africans, it's usually not so strategized as that. Is you got, you had, in terms of slavery, you had those that were in captivity. You had those that were free, supposedly free. John Hope Franklin called them quasi-free. And then you had a mulatto class of Africans. And Du Bois said that that was set up on purpose in the emergence, particularly, of the development of capitalism in America. As you know, our brother Eric Williams out of Jamaica wrote a book called Slavery and Capitalism. And it's about the history of the two systems coming in development of each other. And obviously it's slavery that emerges and builds a capitalist structure that we see today. It is because of the captivity of African people. Without that, you would not have capitalism. Now, when slavery first started, it wasn't capitalism. It was called mercantilism. The system of mercantilism was at work. And that was just that a few merchants were in control of some things, and you were able to do some things around those that were, you know, using services and goods to try to make money. In that case, it was tobacco and sugar and cotton and so forth. But it created a mercantilist class. Capitalism would not come in until late toward the 1800s. It would actually, a very good explanation of that is Karl Marx's book that he wrote, and the whole beginning and the history of that capitalist structure where you have people hoarding wealth at the level that you see now. And so anyway, Du Bois argues that that caste system starts there. And it was an attempt to, again, to strategize the wealth system. So you would have plantations in the South, according to the Du Bois theory, that was around a certain group of Africans. And those that would work those fields would be different than others. Like, for instance, many of the lower southern plantations were very hard. Louisiana, even South Carolina was a very difficult plantation system. Georgia, all of them were difficult, but they were able to strategize in strange ways there. And what Du Bois said, that created a caste within blacks. There would be certain blacks that would be allowed to, for instance, to go to school and learn how to read and write in a limited way, nothing real heavy. And then there were others that would not be allowed to do that. There were those that could work the house and those that had to work the fields only. That's a caste system, according to him. And then everything that would flow from that, even as you looked at the architect and the landscape of a physical plantation, there would be certain huts that the African in captivity lived in that were different than others. Some that would live, that were closer to the house, the plantation, the big house, they call it, were different than those that lived way out by the creek. Those houses were built different. They were shaped different. They were made different. They were lined differently so that it could be easily watched. And that's a whole history that you have to go in and kind of study a little bit. But that's Du Bois's theory of the caste system. And what this shows, this caste system shows, is that that's what we're dealing with today. We're dealing with a caste structure. You have certain schools and certain school areas where teachers are deliberately sent who are not basically trained in a way that's positive. You know, that they have a very limited scope of education, as opposed to, say, a teacher that would get sent to Shorewood or to Menominee Falls. And that's done at the hiring process. And those that may have been trained in universities of upper echelon. And that's the same way with the university system. There are certain schools, universities that you go to and you get a bachelor's degree, but you can't do a whole lot with it because that school doesn't have that rating is necessary to go to a certain level of an employment. That's called a caste system. And that's what Du Bois is arguing about this. He said it was developed in slavery. It continued on into Reconstruction. And when you read his book, Black Reconstruction, he talks about that caste system. And then he says the major thing that developed that caste system among Africans was the whole biological classification of who we were. That's what really created. And we see that in the modern times. There was a study that was done back in 1994 when they were attempting to try to integrate the public schools throughout America. Right here, right in Wisconsin, for instance, there was an attempt to integrate schools in Milwaukee and some areas. But it created a problem because of the fact that there was a study done called the bell curve. And the bell curve said that Africans did not learn at the same level of whites. So therefore, as a result, we need to strategize them out differently. And things like choice and charter came into play around those ideas. Let's let them educate their own creative charter school and let them go there and let them do that because we don't want them over here in this area. We want to keep that area this. We want to keep that area that. And you can get the picture of how that could, how that would work and how that would operate. And so that would be certain school districts that, you know, you could get bussed in, but one or two of them only. And that's what that lawsuit would do. And that was an attempt to stop that lawsuit. And the bell curve was the example of doing that. And the object of the bell curve is they cannot learn anywhere because biologically their brains don't operate at the same level that whites are. There was a study done by the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is a magazine that's used basically mostly by collegiate educators and so forth. And they did a survey in that magazine, and it was an anonymous survey, and they sent out cards to like 10,000 subscribers who were mostly professors, and they made it attractive. They told them if you respond to the survey, you'd get a nice, beautiful, gold-plated ballpoint pen, pen set, and so people were responding a lot based on the gift that they were going to get. And this was the one single question on the questionnaire. Is, do you think that African-Americans learn at the same way that European Americans learn? And that may not be the exact question the way it was worded, but that's really what it was asking. And the survey, once it was done, it came back. 97% said no, they do not learn at the same level they're white. Now, these are university professors, and that 97% was well up into the thousands of people that they asked. So that is a part of the caste that Du Bois is talking about. That's the part of what we see in our school systems today. What the students at Shorewood learn and what the students at Brown Deer learn and what the students over on 32nd and Brown learn is going to be a lot different. Now, there have been attempts to correct that in certain communities. There was an opportunity one time to institute African immersion educational systems where you could come in and they would have all black curriculums. That was done again, even in Wisconsin, they had African-American elementary school, they had African-American junior high school. I don't think they ever had an African-American high school. But again, it was designed that way to teach African-American spirit. I had the opportunity to work in the elementary one as a consultant. And the biggest problem with that was that, again, most of the educators were white, were Europeans. And the schools that they were coming from and their training base had never taught them African-American studies. They didn't teach them about the history of African-American people. So once they went and got their teacher certification, which had nothing about that as well, they then, again, a lot of time was based on their GPAs and so forth, were placed in areas where they would be hired in black school districts, where they did not know what Kwanzaa was. They did not know who W.B. Du Bois was. They didn't know who Marcus Garvey was. And so how could they teach an African-American curriculum without teaching that history or having knowledge of that history? So they brought in a consultant, myself and some others, and they attempted to try to do a course. Well, the problem was the teachers union fought that, because the teachers union said that that would mean that they would have to stay after school, and they were not going to approve them staying after school without being compensated for time and a half. So it ended up being so that they could volunteer and earn college credits in doing that. And so there was a university here called Carroll College that was willing to give them a degree, to give them credits toward their additional certification if they stayed and took these courses. And then the question became, who's going to pay for it? And, well, obviously the student needs to pay for it. And but according to the school, they wanted the union, they thought the school should pay for it. And that wasn't going to happen, so that didn't happen that way. So if you had a population of about 50 teachers, and say 35 of them were white, about 15 of that 35 took the class that they had to teach in an African-American school. So most of their information that they used to teach, which have, by the way, the school was about 98% African-American. And so in order to teach that, they would have to go out and use exterior sources and things like that, or depend upon the library to bring some books in, which was just not adequate of an educational process to create African-American. It's still in effect, but it's difficult, it's challenging. The principal that we had was very adamant about making sure that this system worked. She brought in teachers that she thought could learn or would be willing to learn and volunteer. And so there was some success. Most of the students were economically deprived, and one of the ways that they determined that is they look at how many free lunch program students are part of free lunch. Well, at this particular school, 83% of them were free lunch. Well, what that means is that the parents were below the level, and so obviously the kids had to receive free lunch to do that. So we know we were looking at economic deprivation, educational instruction. They would hold PTA meetings. Three parents would show up at the PTA meeting and so forth. Well, saying all of that, now we're talking about virtual school. We're talking about students who are now going to have to sit in front of a computer and learn how to do PowerPoint. Who's going to teach them that outside of the classroom? Now, I'm not underestimating that there may not be parents that know how to use PowerPoint. The question is, what about them and their working schedule? How are they going to be able to take these, sit there and take these classes and work? A lot of them are out of work, I understand. But it's going to create some very deep shortages that's going to have a long-term effect. And so there are things that are going to go missing. And I'm the kind of person that, you know, I just don't talk about it theoretically. You know, I'll look at it, you know, evidentially. Now, I've got grandchildren, a bunch of them. and there are a few that are around me. And just yesterday, I was watching them as they were using the virtual learning, the computers that were being given to do their homework. I was watching how they were doing that. And it's and one of them is 5, and the other one is like 8, 9. The one that's 8, 9 is good. She's strong. She wanted to learn. She's trying to do it. The 5-year-old, he wanted a sandwich. He wanted to stop and go get a sandwich. He wanted to know, could he have some cookies? You know, he wanted to stop. I said, aren't you supposed to be in school? Yeah, but I'm hungry. You know, so the ability to regiment this process is going to hurt him. So he did a test, and he had 5 questions, and on the test, 4 of them were wrong. He only had 1 right. And because he has there's no instruction, they have to go on. So now his mom's at work. She's got to come home, and she's going to have to work with him. And at about 8:30, he's going to be sleepy. So I'm giving you an example of what the purpose of having this discussion. So what are we going to do? How are we going to address this? And this is going to be on a wide scale. I'm talking from just one little single case. I'm sure that there are other cases very similar to this. And then just like that, going to probably be some successes. I had a friend to send me a copy of the syllabus of a school district here in Wisconsin that is highly upscale. It's a very upscale area. As a matter of fact, it's called the Shorewood School District. And I would say probably 92% of the students are white. And one of the reasons I was very interested in this particular curriculum is they had their students. One of their eighth graders were given a book by Tahiti Coates that they had to read as a part of their English class. And I wanted to see the syllabus on how they were going to do that. And what was interesting, it was highly critical thinking. They wanted her to read this book and then to read an English classic and then take the English classic and compare and contrast it to what she was reading in terms of the Tahiti Coates books and give examples of the differences between the two books. And then to apply some of the things that the book did with the community in which she lives. And so that level of thinking was being implemented. Then I looked at the curriculum, the syllabus for one of my grandchildren. This was for another one who's in the ninth grade. And I asked him to send me a copy of it. Let me see what he had to do. And they wanted him to read I can't think of her name now. It was a nurse. And he was supposed to read her biography of this sipping my mind right now. But he was supposed to read the biography of this nurse and talk about her life and so forth. The level of critical analysis was real shallow for him. And again, he was ninth, which is ready to get to high school, as composed to this one. So we're seeing the difference. And so, and then they would argue more than likely, if you would be brought this to the attention of the administration, is that you had to give them something at the level in which you think they can learn it. And that's the caste system again, going into operation. The students have been cast into structures where they can't learn, so you have to give them, just use this example, a reading book with the 3 little pigs, like versus giving them something like Gulliver's Travels or some other books of a different level. And by no means African-American writers would they give, except some of the stories that we hear that are very shallow and don't require a lot of critical thinking. So this is what we are facing in the midst of COVID, in the midst of police terror, and how to handle that. I think that book by Tahiti Coates that the young student at Shorewood would be real instrumental in using that in a Central City's system with the right teacher using it and handling it. But nevertheless, that's not going to happen. And we're going to see some major, major differences. So that's why historically our ancestors have tried to change this and create these systems where we are educating our children. This is our tax dollars. The choice and charter are not doing it, particularly the choice. People who operate choice schools have good meaning. They mean well. They want to try to help, but they are limited. They don't get the same level of financial compensation to do some of the things that they need to do and hire the right people and buy the right books. That's not there. And if I'm not mistaken, the last time when I was working with a choice school, the choice program was, I don't want to say this, it was a very low amount per child. And it was like almost 50% difference between that and the public education dollars, allocation dollars. But so I won't say it because I'm really not sure. It's been a long time since I really looked at it that way. But major gap. So there's no money to do anything with. You couldn't hire specialized teachers. You couldn't buy brand new books. Most choice schools have handout books, and books that are torn and ripped. They're not able to do the kind of workshops with the teachers that are necessary to introduce new information or help them understand how to infuse a lot of these topics in with other things. That's not done. That's not available because of those dollars. I mean, you have the chapter dollars that sometimes they use to do, but they only use to teach math and English. You know, some of the other courses, they are not able to do that. So the question I throw out to you, brothers and sisters, is what are we going to do? We're just going to sit back and just let this continue on? Are we going to step up and do like Rhoda McCoy did and some of the others out there? People like Baraka, who in New Jersey, who pulled together a group of activists and attempted to try to make some radical change in the school service systems, because they would have to bow to us. I mean, if we really pulled together and force the issue, but a lot of times we just don't want to make that, don't want to do that fight. So that's the question I'm going to ask tonight to our audience, to you. I'm going to open up the lines in just a minute. I'm going to take a quick break. We're at the top of the hour. I'm going to take a quick break, come back, and then we're going to open up and let's see what we can come up with that might very well help and that we can implement and talk to some folk about implementing the things to do that. So let's take this quick break and we'll be right back.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Okay, Brother Timothy, I'm going to come to you, but first let me just quickly mention some of the other programs that we have here on the Black Reality Think Tank, as well as the Time for Awakening. We are on the timeforanawakening.com broadcast system, operating here out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. There are several programs that I just want to mention there. On Mondays from 11 to 1, we have Africa Perspectives with Brother Oshi, Amy Adelabu. That's Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Eastern Time, African Perspectives, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with Brother Oshi. And then on Monday from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Acres of Diamonds, Brother Jihad Ahmed. 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds, Brother Jihad Ahmed. And then from 8 to 9, Black Central Therapy, with host Dr. Sister Cambone and Sister Nataki Cambone, every Monday from 8 to 9 p.m. And then the first and third month, Mondays of each month, we have conversations on reparations within COBRA from 9 to 10 Eastern Time here on the Time for an Awakening Network. And then on Tuesdays, you know, the Black Reality Think Tank. And then on Thursday, from 7 to 9, we have After 7 with host Shani B. This is a group of young millennial women who talk about many issues that face them, things like education, children, families, relationships, husbands, and all of those things that go along with that age group and what they're facing each and every day. And then on Friday, Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, 8 to 10 Eastern Time, Time for an Awakening with Brother Richard and Brother Elliot. And then on Saturday, from 4 to 6, we've got Black Sister Talk with LaWanda Chambers. Black Sister Talk from 4 to 6 Eastern, 3 to 5 Central. Dynamic Conversation. She's a mental health therapist talking about stress and some of the things that impact the community in that way. And then on later the evening, we have from 6 to 8 Central, 7 to 9, we have the Elders of Sankofa with host Alfonso Watkins. Brother Watkins has been out ill. He has not been on. I'm hoping he'll be able to continue. If not, then maybe we will hopefully find a replacement that can do that Elders of Sankofa program. But hopefully he is recuperating and will be back with us very shortly. And then on Sunday from 7 to 9, again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard, Time for an Awakening. And that is the lineup of the Time for an Awakening network system. And we appreciate you. You know, you can go to our website at www.timeforanawakening.com. Go up into the search portal, put in any one of the program names, and you can listen to these broadcasts 24/7. At your leisure. So we hopefully that you will do that and obviously keep continuing to follow. Okay, so with that, Brother Timothy, I've called on you because I know you're an educator. You're working in the Philadelphia school system a little bit. Do you see, let me ask you this question, I'd like for you to answer the question, then you can get into what you think about the school. Do you see that,
yes, sir.
That caste system that our elder, our esteemed ancestor elder W. Du Bois was talking about among school systems as well as among students. Do you see that caste system operating?
Yes, I do, sir. I'm going to say this, that I'm 59 years old, and I'm a product of the public school, but I happen to be fortunate to have a mother that was educated, and I have cousins and aunts and uncles who made sure that I got an education. That was a thing in my family. But in Catholic schools and also public schools, they had something like almost a tracking system. In other words, especially Catholic school, mm-hmm. they had a way of putting blacks in a track that was different from the whites. Yep. And in public schools, they had different you in a different section from the time I was from the time I was fourth grade to eighth grade. And your behavioral problems, who were mostly the children who were more aggressive because of their culture, they had a way of putting you in a different track and separating from the other students. That's one thing. That was a thing that if parents knew better, they'd say, no, I don't want my son in that section. I want my son not doing with the regular students. That was a trick that was played on us.
Right.
And right, exactly. So what you gave me some good history about this Dr. McCoy. That was some interesting stuff. And I'm going to say this to you, sir, what experience that I had. You know, when COVID hit us in March, I had the grandchildren with me in my house teaching them. We had lunch. We did breakfast. We went to the playground, and they had a curriculum going on with math and English and social studies. I had that. And so I had a time with having them. But the thing about it is we had a little intimate group, and it was great. I couldn't bring anybody else in there because of what was going on with the COVID. But something that the public school system needs, sir, whether people disagree with it or not, we need an elected school board in Philadelphia. You say to me, why, Brother Timothy? Because we have a superintendent, and his name is Dr. Height. Mm-hmm. And every time you turn around, mayor picks a superintendent. He's not even from the city. And that's where the politics come in. Somebody comes from the city, doesn't understand the structure. An elected school board, you could elect the superintendent in, and if you don't like him, every 3 years you elect another person. So we're stuck with a superintendent from another place, and he's from Washington. He's been different places. He's from the last place he taught was a PG County. And I knew Dr. Rogers in March, when COVID hit Philadelphia, that the school system was going to be where it's at. First of all, the Chromebooks that they're giving them are breaking. they did better with the food in March. Not only are they had the lineup for the cookbooks because they didn't give them to them this summer. The whole thing is disorganized. Not only that, the parents have to go to work. They can't be in the places with the children to make sure that they're zooming on in the computers. High school are worse because the students not picking them, the Chromebook out at all. It's going to hit us most because we're just already in handicap in our race. So is it hitting us? Is it a blow for us? Without a doubt. And my thing is, sir, like you said, if we got to go back to the churches, the mosques, the tabernacles, to where we started off with education, we need to go back there because they don't have a structure. And I'm going to tell you something. A lot, that's what, they don't have Wi-Fi. They don't have a lot of things to be in their homes. So, you know, they're in their homes making this a time of play. And parents sometimes can't leave their jobs to help.
No, they can't.
Like the grandchildren are in daycare. And guess what? They don't have certified teachers in those daycare to make sure they're zooming in on the computer with the Chromebook. It's messed up in Philadelphia. And it's like I talked to some friends in Florida. It's worse in Florida.
Yeah, same thing. I've talked to some. It's just as bad. You know, the parent can't be there every minute watching while the kids are operating those computers and talking and having those classes. It's just not possible based on the socioeconomic circumstances of our community.
That's exactly right. So, see, sir, we lack in discipline. And one thing, if our ancestors knew how we took advantage of education, they're turning over in their graves right now because we don't always take it serious. And it's hitting us worse now because I realize that, and you realize that, the things that we don't take serious than that we should be, we're going to hit by not doing what we're supposed to do and being very undisciplined. That's a start.
Right.
I mean,
see,
Dr. Rogers, it's worse. It's worse than what, listen to me, it's worse than what I'm telling you.
Do you
believe
see
it.
Saturday schools working? Do you see that as a possibility in your area? Do you think that there are organizations that can come together and create some alternative educational processes for the children in Philadelphia?
See what you just said? I had a friend of mine, Dr. Montero, and he did Saturday schools, but guess what? You can't go into churches. The churches, not letting people in the basements of the churches
right.
to do what they have to do.
Okay, what about Zoom?
Yeah.
How about using Zoom as a system?
Well, Zoom, fine, if everybody has a computer. The structure, the equipment. Dr. Rogers, this hit us hardest. It really hit us the most hardest. But I'm saying some people who are prepared, some people aren't. But it's the ones who are prepared are shocked. Because educators I know say, now I have to, they more bogged down with work in their home than they were in the classroom.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Sister Jan, you had an opportunity to go to a private school that was created out of that black movement, black nationalist movement. And I know this was many, many years ago, and I'm not going to say too many minutes, but many, many years ago. What do you think? Does it work? Will it work?
Greetings of peace and love. Always got to give us some love because we certainly need it.
Thank you. We do. We do.
Yes. How you doing, Doc?
Doing wonderful. Doing wonderful.
Good. Brother Timothy, I love what you contributed. That was just so on point. So I'm actually, I was, you know, just listening and thinking about the fact that how this system, you know, was set up in terms of black folk for us to fail, for Africans to fail. So that was already done. And now with COVID and, you know, just all of the stuff that's going on, like as you mentioned in the beginning, Doc, from what I heard, we have no choice but to go back to nation building.
Okay.
That's just the bottom line for me. I think of the black children that I hear about and I see just running the streets with no guidance already, you know,
mm-hmm.
Skipping school already or like Brother Timothy was saying, undisciplined, just the things that we already have. There's no way in the world that our children are going to be educated the way things are in this climate. Parents who have to work are not having adequate equipment, can't afford this or that. This is just not good. I can't see this working for the masses. So my question, or not even, you know, I'm pretty much done with questions now. When are we going to, and how are we going to begin to communicate nationally where black folk can set up a nationalist way of moving forward? That's the only thing I see. I don't see any options.
You're right.
I don't. With the attacks on us, this is an obvious genocide. Now, I was listening to Dr. Umar Johnson last night. It seems like, mm-hmm. you know, hopefully he's coming back to us. You know what I mean? And he was talking about the worldwide attack on African people and how everybody is where black people are. Everybody's taking over, buying up the land, mm-hmm. Jamaica, Africa, wherever we are. Everybody's got control except for us.
Right.
So we better come up with a plan and strategy and come up with it quick. Because I think it's getting real, it looks like it's getting real serious, and I don't think we're taking it seriously enough. And let me just say this last thing. I always say that, but, you know, black folk, we've gotten stuck with this mentality of trying to save a sinking ship. America is sinking, is breaking down, and so much of us, you know, so many of us want to vote it, you know, back together, you know, pull Humpty Dumpty back together. I don't think that's possible, but we get stuck as a people, and somehow we're going to help save the world or save the nation. That ain't going to happen either.
No, it's not. Definitely.
So I'd like to see us come up out of that mentality, and I'm done.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dr. Rogers.
Thank you.
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. How are you?
Oh, good. Great. Doing great.
I'm listening to your program, another great program. I thank you so much for the work that you're doing. Black Reality Think Tank is definitely a program that more people should listen to.
Thank you, sir.
One of the things that I was wanted to comment on was the fact that in the South, many people, especially the children that live in the rural areas, don't have access to the internet. And what they're trying to do now is to place hotspots on school buses so that those school buses could drive out to those outlying areas so the children will have access to internet. And then I've also heard that there are children who have computers, but their parents don't have the necessary skills to help them with the computer and with the internet. So I agree with your guests who are speaking that this is going to be a holy mess.
Yes, it is.
This education system that's going on right now. I don't know how this is going to play out. But one thing I wanted to ask you, yes. Isn't this a good time? Since children, I'm talking about those parents who have the skills, those parents who are homeschooling their children. Wouldn't this be a good time for them to interject some self-consciousness into a curriculum for them? I'm not talking about replacing the curriculum. I'm talking about adding something extra since they are at home and they are being trained by their parents. Wouldn't this be a good time to interject some books or some black consciousness understanding into a child's curriculum?
No doubt about it. And that's exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about Saturday schools. And that needs to happen now, right now. It doesn't. You don't need to wait. Somebody needs to do that now. I was a part of a program this summer that did it, and it was very successful. They had 15 young people, including their parents, that were coming to these workshops on Wednesday evening, on Wednesday afternoons. And we were there for 2 hours, and we talked about African spirituality system. And those kids were real enthused. They had never heard of some of that stuff before. They didn't know what Ma'at was. They didn't understand that. But then when we left, they understood Ma'at. They understood what Sankofa was. And you're right, Reverend Roddy, you're right. No doubt about that. And, And the question I'm asking is, how do we do that? Who does it start with? And I think it starts like Harriet Tubman. You know, she didn't have a, you know, we've got to have a Harriet Tubman moment again. And go to Underground Railroad if we have to. You don't have to be necessarily super trained to do that. You know? So I agree with you, Reverend Rogers. I agree with you 100%. Thank you very much. Thank you. Reverend Rogers, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay.
I'm still here.
All right. So thank you. Thank you so much on that.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, Brother Herbie White, is that, do you think this is a conspiracy?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers, and to everyone else listening on the show. First thing I want to say is about Ocean Hill, Brownsville. I was there. I was living in Ocean Hill, Brownsville.
That's right. You were.
My younger brother was a student at Junior High School 271, which was Ground Zero. And so I witnessed all of what was going on. And that devil, Albert Shanker, the president of the UFT, was a real, real devil. And they were determined that black parents was not going to have no say-so in who taught their children and what they were taught.
Right.
White paternalism was not going to allow that to exist.
I remember that.
And one of the other things that happened during that time, when all the demonstrations were taking place and everything was going on, I was taking my brother to school. The police department, what they did, all of the police that was up there were black cops.
Uh-huh.
They put all black cops on the front line so that if something broke out, it wouldn't be a question of white cops attacking black people.
Right.
It would be black cops on black people.
It was carefully orchestrated. You're right. And that was
yeah.
John Lindsay. That
but
was Lindsay.
The educational system in America is a controlling system. It's designed to control and manipulate and maintain the power structure of the white supremacy.
Right.
They need to know what black students are doing, how much progress they're making, and how much needs to be done to make sure that they don't make any progress.
That's right.
So, like you said earlier about if you went to this school or you went to that school or you went to the other school, like we had this scandal recently with all them white people who was paying to get their children into certain schools because they would have the advantage of saying, I got a degree from this particular school.
Right.
And that would gain them access.
Right.
So that's just all, the whole thing is a controlling system anyway. And it's not designed to help us.
It surely isn't. And you know, I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And as far as what's taking place now, this is never going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Because a computer can't educate a person.
No way.
A computer can give you information, but you, to educate a person, there has to be a relationship between the educator and the person being educated.
True.
Because the educator has to understand and feel his students, what they need and how they're responding. I worked for the Board of Education. I was an educational assistant, and I worked in a summer camp, and I was supposed to be helping a teacher, but the one in charge gave me my own class because it had a reading. In the summer camp, they had a reading component. You had an hour of reading every day. So I had a class, you know, six classes of reading. And The first thing I found out was when I was having problems was that the children were coming to class and they had their own problems. And so they were not concerned with what was going on in the reading class. So when I recognized that, the first thing I did when the class, when the students sat down, we would have a conversation. How you all feeling? What's going on? I want to call my mother, but they won't let me call my mother. All right, I'll talk to the people. And I worked out their problems.
Right. That's what you end up being.
With them. Mm-hmm. And whatnot, to calm them down and get them in the mindset where now they felt that I cared about them and they would respond. A computer can't do that.
No, it can't.
A computer can't do that. So a computer can give you information, but it can't give you wisdom.
No, it can't.
How to think, how to feel, how you should respond to things. A computer will tell you something, it doesn't know how you're going to respond to it, it doesn't care. Because it's not a person. It doesn't address your needs. A good educator addresses the needs of the people that they're educating. That's why the old schools in the South, where the teachers were the people in the community and a small group, and everybody knew everybody. And the teachers loved the children. They knew the children. I'll just give you a quick story, and then I'll let go. When I came down here and I went to Hillside for that half a year,
yeah.
And I was living with my aunt, and one day I was in my room, and my aunt came and knocked on my door. She said, come in my room. I want to talk to you. And I went in her room, and there on her chaise lounge was my English teacher sitting there drinking tea. What are you doing? What is this teacher doing in my house?
Wow.
That changed my whole relationship. Because now the teacher was family.
That's true. That was a time when the teachers had to visit the homes of the students before the school started. They would go and visit each student in their class. Because my mother was a teacher. She used to take me with her. We would go and sit there, and she would talk about things, and expectations.
When you go to school and the teacher can call your parents by their first name, you got a problem.
You sure do.
You know, ain't gonna be no shenanigans.
I want to just mention something about the education system, the Board of Education. This is an area that we need to be mindful of when you talk about the shenanigans that are going on and the possibilities of the conspiracy concepts and ideas, is the Board of Education of every city and area is a fat cash cow. Serious money is made in the Board of Education system involving, you know, the whole industry. Somebody is selling food, toilet paper, soap, paper towels. There are contractors that are using that. So the procurement system of these educational structures are extremely powerful. So there's millions of dollars being made on an annual basis by corporations who are going to have their fingers on the decision-making process of a lot of these schools. I remember the Koch brothers, before the one that recently passed, talking about he was going to have a curriculum rewritten to pass out through all of the schools that would talk about the greatness of America. And come to find out he can regulate legislatures to do that, because he was one of the major major contractors to most of the public schools. They sell them paper towels and soap and all that stuff. And other things, textbooks. Think about how much materials are being used in a school when it's in process on a given day. And don't you think that these industries are lobbying in the state capitals to make sure certain decisions are made that would support their industry and what they're doing? So that's something you really have to look at. I remember we had a brother once that was on the school board that said, you better watch the procurement list if you want to understand what the politics is of a school system. Look at who's supplying industry to that area. And then you'll see some things that will help you understand much better. So, Brother Lush, what do you think about this? I don't know what
Good evening, everyone. Uhuru and Habari Ghani. You know, Brother Rogers, this is a very tough question. The question, what does it mean to be educated in the age of COVID? And it's a big and it's a tough question, but I'm sure there are answers. As for me, although it's been a while since being inside the classroom, I mean, like way before Hurricane Katrina, I've been kind of taking it from a different angle in that if I'm in Walmart or some other grocery store or business where there's a line, I try to, especially if there are young children or young adults that's in line with their parents, I try to work on their intellectual curiosity. What do I mean by that? Just to ask, say, a basic question, of course, with the permission of the parent, to ask the child or student, what did they learn today that they never knew before? To try to get those neurons stimulated, to try to get them thinking about something. And so even though I'm not in the classroom per se, try to at least be of service in a sense where a conversation is started. Look, we don't need to learn like the white European counterpart. We don't need to worry about how they learn. It's about how we learn, and it's about what we need to do. And so even though traditionally there is the classroom and various learning circles, but this thing called education can happen anywhere and at any time. So to try to stimulate that intellectual curiosity, even not just in children, but in adults themselves, to try to get that dialogue, that one-on-one, mano-a-mano conversation going to get folks to think. And so I think that if we can just take that time out, just that 5 minutes, that 10 minutes while we're waiting in line, to try to spur a conversation of sorts, to get those juices flowing, and try to come away with learning something from them and they from you. So this is my outlook on it and the approach as it pertains to education in the age of COVID-19.
Okay. That's interesting too, and you're right. And that's really the question that we've got to ask. That we got to ask that on several levels. You got to ask it as a parent, and then you have to ask it as a community, and you have to be able to come up with some answers. I really think that we have to do that, and it has to be done soon, you know, because you're going to have to confront these young people in some way, sometime, and you don't want them to have a reduced knowledge of the world and how things are, because if you can do this here and do the damage here, then you don't have to worry about them in voting terms of voting and making money and starting businesses and all that stuff. You don't have to worry about that because it's a self-inflicted kind of thing. So I do agree with you. You got to ask that question. How do we begin to do that? We don't know what COVID is. We're not quite sure what all of that is. But I think whatever it is, it could be very well be dangerous, and you have to take our time and respond, and you can't be getting together in groups, and you're going to have to use your mask. I don't know. You know, it's just really your thoughts. So thank you, Brother Lush. I appreciate that, your comments.
Yeah, thank you
very much. But is that you, Brother Marcus? How you doing today?
Oh, you hearing me?
Yes, I do. Yes, sir.
Yes, brother. Brother Dr. Rogers, I am with that last brother there that came on, Brother Lush.
Brother Lush, right, okay.
This is an opportunity. You see, because I tell you what they're doing here in Memphis. In Memphis, they give the kids a device and they give you a hot spot. You see? So, you know, and this is an opportunity for the parents to learn too. You see?
Okay.
A computer ain't that difficult to learn, you know. You can buy a computer and learn to operate it because it actually tells you what to do. It walks you through the thing. So this is an opportunity for parents to learn. It's an opportunity for children to learn. And they have the greatest learning tool right there in their hand, that computer, and Google it.
Right.
You don't know the answer? Google it. Google have the answer. So you got the device in your hand. You know, remember back in the day, you used to have a whole book, encyclopedia. You don't need an encyclopedia no more. You got it right here in your hand.
No, not at all.
And black people, we really use it. You know that. We like stupid people. You give us lemon, we make lemonade. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
This may be his biggest blunder, because all the information we need is right there on that device. Using the information to liberate our mind is right there on that piece of device.
Okay. All right.
Home, backfire on him.
Okay.
Take care, good brothers.
All right. Thank you so much, and Brother Marcus. All right.
You're coming in real low on tuning. I don't know. You see, they're working in the background. Mizungo working in the background. So you're coming in real low, I'm telling you.
Oh, okay. Okay.
All right.
Thank you. 1295, what do you think? What are your thoughts on this system? You're in a different educational setting. Do you see any impact of that?
I was so impressed with what these last two speakers said in terms of answering your questions about what kind of things can we do. And I think that, you know, they came up with some really good suggestions that seem to be optimistic. And so I like the part about, you know, education can take place anywhere. So how do we begin to help educate. I love that brother. Even the question that he asked was, you know, so insightful, and I just wish that maybe I get in contact with him, and, you know, we have a list of questions that we can ask our children and to generate conversation. I had a conversation
with a
cousin today, I didn't know she was younger because we were just communicating over, she's in the Bahamas, and I didn't know. But we generated this conversation that went on and on and on. It was almost like a debate. But what happened is it got her to thinking. It got me to researching. So like the brother said, our information is right there. So, you know, you can look at various sources of information. I think, to explore and to educate yourself and to get knowledge. And then it's important that if the parents don't understand something, that they have networks with other teachers or other people that they can call and ask, you know, girl, instead of talking about what's on Empire or whatever, you know, hey, you know what, my child has this math question, do you know about it? I mean, so our conversations have to be geared towards, you know, how is it that we want to, you know, educate. So we can't be talking about the latest dress or this, that, and our conversations have to be, you know, have to be more structured and geared toward a certain purpose. And so if that purpose is that we want to, you know, help to stimulate knowledge, critical thinking, then those are the kind of things that we have that we have to do and, you know, ask those kind of questions. Because I knew, you know, I'm always calling you, asking you this question. I love to learn. So not everybody, you know, wants to do that. But I think also some kind of way we've got, I like what the brother was saying about the one-on-one relationships. I went to an African-American school, historical college, and I felt the difference. But I also felt the difference when I went to a predominantly white school and there was a white assistant principal who really saw a skill in me, a talent, and really encouraged me. So I think it's the point of encouraging our children about their interests. And those interests that we encourage them with can morph or grow into something more.
Right.
So I don't have all the answers, but I think we have to be optimistic in terms of how do we capture the interests of our children or, you know, people in our community, our relatives, these young people trying to learn. It's a wonderful opportunity for us to learn as well. I've even offered to a couple of my girlfriends who have to work. I've said, you know what, as long as your children wear masks and we keep a little social distance, I am willing to come over, you know, once a week or twice a week and really just kind of help them move through some of their, you know, educational questions and things of that sort because I
That's
like
good.
Teaching.
That's
but,
good.
You know, and I think that if you got a lot of retired teachers, you got a lot of, you know, maybe if, I don't know, maybe the church, you know, churches could put something back in the community. Now, you know, okay, it may not happen, but what are the churches doing to help, you know, stimulate, lend a hand? I mean, maybe they could have sessions where the children come and they're not just doing Bible study, but they're actually, you know, keeping their social distance, engaging in talk, but it's related to academics. I mean, a lot of children went to church and learned how to play the drums and musical instruments and
right, exactly.
so on and so forth. So why aren't we bringing, why aren't we doing something now? When it comes to academics,
I love that because.
So I think we have to be creative and optimistic in what and how we go about this. We really do.
Right, I like
okay,
that. I like mm-hmm. that because very clearly right now the churches have to use the Zoom system to do their have their Sunday services now because they can't they're not congregating. Very clearly somebody can take the initiative and maybe hold. A class a week where they read a book, have a book club online, you know. And that's what I'm trying to initiate here, some kind of idea system that people can use to work with our babies because you're going to lose them. You're going to feel this in a few years from now. You're going to see the damaging results of all of this. So thank
that's
you so
right.
much. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Dr. Rogers,
and
can I say something?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
In an African education system, culture is the most important thing. You start with your spirituality. And your culture teaches you what kind of individual to be a service to your community.
Right.
A European education system teaches you to make money.
Right.
Yeah.
However you make it, whoever you make it off of. It doesn't matter whether you have to rob your neighbor, your best friend, or your family. But African system, culture comes first. What kind of human being are you? Your education is not going to do you no good if you don't know what kind of human being to be.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. And that's it. It makes you, it forces us to go back to the real purpose of education anyway. As a people, as a culture, and you really, clearly are raising that issue. You know, our community was educating our community because we are communal people, and we have to be able to work together in things, you know, across the board. That's the way it used to be. You know, like you said, Brother Wright, you and I come from the same area. We know that how it was there. You know, it was a communal process. On Saturdays, we used to have all kind of different clubs you go to. And we would go just to be able to socialize, but at the same time, we were learning, too. And I think that needs to happen. Let me go to Brother Lance. Brother Lance, so glad to have you back on. I don't know if you'd like to say something, but do you have any thoughts about
this educational process in the era of COVID?
Yes, sir, dear brother and family. Good evening. I've heard and listened to everyone, and I agree with just about everything I've said. We all have charted the analysis.
Yeah.
We know the problem, and we're seeking a solution. The couple of things. I remember Reverend Pridgen was here in Greensboro back, I forget the name of the church, but the school system made an announcement that about, I think it was 60 to 70% of African-American boys are failing in the public schools in North Carolina.
Wow.
And the preachers got together, and I'll never forget it, and they called the school superintendent of Bigger County, and he wouldn't come. They called three or four times. He never came. So at the meeting, you know, I said, well, I'd like to lift up tonight. I did the same thing that evening. I said, you know, our teachers, the people who attend these churches, they're the teachers in the schools.
Right. That's true.
They teach our children. So I said, why are we begging this man to come to this meeting? He's ignoring you. I said, bring the children this Sunday. Every preacher, call them out of the schools. We're not going in no more. We can open up the churches, and I want the teachers, those parishioners, to teach here in the pews that they have. Bring them out of the schools. And that's what they did. And guess who showed up and called for a meeting?
Yeah.
The superintendent. Now he wants to meet. Why? Because every child represents what, $6,000 to $8,000 at the beginning of a school year? It's all about the money. Just to miseducate our children. The second piece, I think we need to go back to that. The second piece is we're all scrambling for, because parenthetically we know the system is rotten. It's not working for us.
No, it's not. Not at all.
We called on the ancestors. We called on our old folkways, our norms, right? And the things we used to do. But we understand we can't do it in the day of COVID.
Right.
Our house is on fire. It's on fire. There's no smoke at this point. It's life and death. In terms of our existence, the furtherance of our issues, our causes, our way of life, whether we live or not, both here and on the continent. I serve today as an ambassador to Africa. So my point is, look at what's happening in the Sudan right now. Look at look what's happening with the AU, the division, the lack of will to get things done. We need a total revisiting of our mind, our thinking.
Right.
I would lift up that we call on all our friends. It's time now for a national discussion among us. For black people, a revival for black survival. We have to have a serious discussion about where we are, what the future, and we have to forecast down the will of time. How will this affect our children? Where are we going today? What does this look like 5, 10 years? And then we pinpoint certain talking points that will lead us to an eventual end. We have to, this has to be programmatic, it has to be systematic, and this has to be a national, not just the big leagues. We need to have it in all the churches. This really needs to happen. It's critical.
It really needs to happen.
The house is on fire.
You're so right.
In Africa, when I talk to brothers and I serve some of them that are in AU, look at how France is just ravaging the country. Look at what the Chinese are doing. Look at what the Indians are doing. And we as the black men, and I'm going to talk to us for a minute.
Please do.
Because at the end of the day, it's on me. It's on you. Our children, our wives, and our sisters are dependent on us, and we're failing. If we die in the cause, damn it, we need to die then. At least we die fighting. You understand?
That's
now,
exactly.
I get it. I'm former law enforcement. I totally get it. I'm not trying to say I'm bad. It has nothing to do with that. But this is survival in a real sense. They're killing our children through the educational system. We all know it.
We see what they're doing on the continent. We see what they're doing here in America. At what point, brothers? At what point? At what point do we love enough each other, our people, our women, and our children? At what point?
Right.
Do we do another million man march, or we do a, or whatever you want to call it? That day when we united, we didn't take no action. But this time it has to be programmatic. This time we got to commit to each other that, look, I'm going to spend with this. Tell them to spend my money. If it ain't black, damn it, I ain't buying it.
Right.
And be very real about it. And building business and schools, take them out of there. Just take them the hell out. Take them out.
Right.
We did it in North Carolina. We did it in Greensboro. I said, take them out and bring all the teachers, the black teachers. You will, when you go to church, that's where you're going to see that. All that, bring, that brought them to their knees.
I like that.
Please, let us consider having a national discussion. If we can get together, have another discussion, because in preparation of a broader discussion among us as a people about where do we go from here, programmatic steps, and it doesn't have to be anything, you know, elaborate, basic things, like just getting to know, get to know each other and love, learn to love each other again. How about that? Our division is killing us, family, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, Brother Lance, I'm going to reach out to you on that thought, because I've had that same thought as you have, and I'm going to do that when we got a little bit more time to talk about how to make that happen.
And Brother, said a mouthful.
Is that good? Is that good, Brother Lance?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Sister Dee Dee, did you want to say something?
Brother Lance said a mouthful, man.
Okay.
He said a mouthful. And Baba Rogers, you know, I always feel like things that are being done, I always feel like they're there by design.
Right.
And the pandemic is by design.
Okay.
And it's hitting us the hardest. Why? By design. And we do need to pay more close attention to our children's education, and then with them on these computers all the time, because, you know, we can't leave out, you're staring at a computer 8-9 hours a day with their little eyes or whatever, you know, what is that doing to them?
That's true.
And they do need to learn how to pick up a book. You know, sometimes maybe we need to ask them, you know, about reading something, or what's your favorite book, or your favorite subject. And then I like what the other guy said, the one guy, you know, when he said that he had asked someone when he was in Walmart and he was speaking to someone.
Right.
You know, having dialogue with these young people, with our kids, our children. It's just so...
Okay.
Man.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, thank you so much. Brother Oshie, I see you on the line. I think that's you. Glad to have you back. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Dr. Rogers. All How are you doing?
Wonderful. So glad to meet you. Sound real strong.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you,
nice
Dr.
To
Rogers.
You, Brother Oshie.
Thank you, my sister. Thank you very much. Hey, it's good to be heard.
Okay.
I hear you, brother.
Yeah. But excellent conversation tonight, Dr. Rogers.
Thank
and,
you, sir.
I mean, the bottom line is that we must educate ourselves.
Yes.
We must educate
yes.
our children. This is our responsibility. You know, my daughter went to Whitefish Bay in the Chapter 220 program.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they were out of school because a lot of European Jews send their kids to that public school. But yet they say to them, they're not going to be in school this day or that week because of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur,
yeah, right.
Hanukkah,
right.
or whatever.
That's right.
You
that's
know,
right.
because the responsibility to teach young European Jews about their culture and their tradition and their religion is there. And it's done at the synagogue, it's done in centers and so forth.
That's right.
They just want those kids to learn math and science and so forth. But they don't care about them educating those kids in that way. Because in terms of who they are as European Jews, that is their responsibility.
Right.
And our problem is that we put all the onus on a public school, a parochial school, and a charter school, you know, thinking that these folks will give our children a well-rounded education.
Hmm.
And then, but education for what?
That's
education
it.
For what?
That's right. We've got to ask that.
Dr. Clark said education should be about handling power. Mm, and baby, and what that means, what that means is shaping and fashioning your reality in your image and interest. Mm-hmm. You controlling who you are, your environment, your resources. That's what it means. That's power. Power is the ability to define reality. Power is not politics. Power ain't no damn voting. Power ain't education information. Power ain't money. Power is the ability to define reality. Europeans define reality. And the question that we need to ask ourselves is, who are we in their reality?
That's
first,
right.
We were the soulless people, no culture to speak of, running around the jungle with a rag up our ass and a bone through our nose, as they tell it. As they tell it.
I love it.
But who are we in their reality today? Drug addicts, no fit fathers, no fit mothers, criminals, the scourge.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm saying to us is that we must understand what we are up against. And we must, because we're handing our children over. And you heard all the time, many of our great ancestors and scholars said, no one hand their children over to a people who have treated us the way they have. They are truly an enemy.
That's
but
right.
yet we do it. But I hope some of your listeners can listen tomorrow to my program, Doc.
Yeah, good.
I'm going to do my 9/11 piece because I couldn't do it Friday.
Okay.
The server was down.
Okay.
So I'm going to talk about that. The inside job that is.
Oh, that's
but
excellent.
Doc,
that's
great
excellent.
Program, brother.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
And that program is from 11 to 1 Eastern time and
Eastern.
10 to 12
time.
Central time. So look forward to
right. Thanks,
listening
Doc.
To that. Okay, no problem.
From 11 to 1 p.m., Doc?
11 to 1 Eastern now, and 10 to 12 Central. So if you're in Milwaukee, Chicago, those places, you got it's 10 to 12. Okay,
10
well.
10 to 12?
Yeah, 10 to 12. Well, brothers and sisters,
you.
I think we have... raise some questions. I really like what Brother Lance said. I'm going to definitely reach out to him and anybody else, and we're going to come back. I'm so happy that Reverend Rogers called in. He has a black church out of North Carolina. Maybe we can even talk about him and look at some ways that maybe we can do a some type of learning in that perspective. I think we have to do that, you know, and as Brother Lance said, we got to do that. It's not even a question. And so very clearly we want to begin to do. I'm so happy that you all have joined me today. We will be back again next Tuesday, as usual, from 7 to 9 Central, 8 to 10 Eastern. So thank you, brothers and sisters. I will look forward. I will see you next week. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know you're asking
thank
today,
you.
How long will it take?
Okay.
Somebody's asking how long will prejudice blind the visions of men.
Uh-huh.
I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir.
However frustrating the hour, it will not be long,
no,
because truth crushed to earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long?
How
not long.
How long?
Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes, sir.
Yet that scaffold sways the future.
Yes,
behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Yes, sir.
How long?
Not
long.
Not long.
Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yes, sir.
He's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. He's loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword.
Yes, sir.
His truth is marching on.
Yes, sir.
He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat.
Yes,
he is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat.
Yes,
oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on.
Yes.
Glory, hallelujah.
Yes,
glory, hallelujah.
Yes,